Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is another episode of our series, Flashback Friday. Party like it's 1999. So tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mambo number 5.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club.
That is not my recollection. My recollection is that I did not have sexual relations.
Oh, for you.
If you ask the question, where will the Y2K computer bug do serious damage? The answer is, no one really knows.
Goodbye.
It has been 20 years since we first heard the name Tony Soprano. January 10th marked two decades since the premiere of the hit TV show The Sopranos on HBO. What was TV like before the New Jersey mob boss walked into a psychiatrist's office to talk about his relationship with his mother? How did The Sopranos change TV history? And even now, people still debate that closing scene in the 2007 finale. Did Tony die? Was it just a meditation on death and life? Cut to black. TV critics Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall wrote the book The Soprano Sessions. They both worked at the Star-Ledger in New Jersey, Tony Soprano's favorite newspaper, by the way. It launched their careers critiquing the intricacies of The Sopranos over its seven seasons. Alan is now chief TV critic for Rolling Stone, and Matt is editor-at-large at RogerEbert.com and the television critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. Matt and Alan, welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So, Matt, tell us what the TV landscape was like pre-Sopranos, so we can kind of get ourselves in the head of why this was such a phenomenal, why it was such a phenom.
Well, it, you know, there had been artistically interesting television shows prior to the arrival of The Sopranos, but one thing, a number of things The Sopranos did were notable. One was it was heavily serialized, although maybe not as strongly as the shows that came after. And it was stylistically very, very complicated. I mean, it had satire, it had domestic drama, it had sort of mob violence and intrigue, and dream sequences, and all sorts of things. It all mixed together, and somehow tonally it worked. And I think most importantly, it was a series that had not just one, but a bunch of essentially bad people at the center of it, like people we wouldn't approve of. And there were no characters who were on the show regularly whose job was to remind us of what correct behavior was. And the only exception to that might have been Dr. Melfi. And even she had her moments where she seemed like she was complicit with or sympathetic to these characters. And there have been so many TV shows, and Alan can speak to this in more detail, that have broken off a piece of The Sopranos. Like whatever they thought The Sopranos was, they zeroed in on that one or two aspects of it. But I don't think any of them quite captured the totality of what this was. It really did feel like a singular thing.
What are some shows that owe their success, or at least their ramping off, to The Sopranos?
How much time do we have? I mean, basically, all of television in the year 2019 is the way it is because of The Sopranos. It's scripted television at any rate. It's the most imitated scripted series since I Love Lucy, the most influential one. All of these things that Matt just described were things that for 50 years, television producers had been told by television executives, you cannot do this. The audience will reject you if you do this. And instead, The Sopranos came along, was a huge hit. And thus, as a result, everyone else followed in. So you had immediately after it, Six Feet Under, The Shield, The Wire, Deadwood, eventually Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Boardwalk Empire, every show on Netflix.
The American, Sons of Anarchy.
Game of Thrones would not exist without it. You know, the entire ecosystems of pay cable and streaming television are here because of this show.
You can have the anti-hero lead. Mm-hmm. You can kill off major characters.
Yes.
What else can you do that's Soprano-esque?
You can challenge people. You can have ambiguity in terms of morality and narrative. Like, you don't always have to tell the audience what happened, you know, up to and including how you end your show. All of these things. You know, before The Sopranos, there was this theory that research showed that even dedicated fans of a show watched one out of every four episodes of it, which sounds ludicrous now in this age where, like, you just binge one season and move on to something else.
That's interesting. I was going to say, how did The Sopranos change our viewing habits? Well, influence that I should say.
It was a show. It was one of the probably one of the singular shows of the late 90s, early aughts that people discussed as if it were a puzzle or a work of art or something. Like, you could have those kinds of discussions about it. And there were lots of different ways to watch the show. And the different people who were attracted to different aspects of the show often found themselves in conflict with each other. And Alan and I saw that writing at the Star Ledger, which is, you know, the paper that Tony picked up at the end of his driveway. And they shot the show in our circulation area, like mainly in northern New Jersey, but all over the state. And so you saw the crews out there. And the audience was mostly very excited and appreciative, but there were some complaints from Italian-American anti-defamation activists and also people who just objected to the violence. And they objected to the fact that this show about criminals was on the air every week and was such a big deal. And then even among fans of the show, there were people who liked the mob stuff, but they didn't like the domestic stuff with Carmela and the children, or they didn't like the psychiatry, they didn't like the dream sequences, and they didn't like anything that was sort of arty and off-center. Like, they really lost it, you know, when there were like a 20-minute dream sequence in the episode The Test Dream, or that entire arc of episodes where Tony got shot and was in essentially purgatory, you know, and imagining he was a heating salesman, Kevin Finnerty. They didn't know what to make of that, and they wanted the show to be one thing but not all the others. But, of course, it was the totality of the show that made it what it was.
I'm from the 07028, so...
There you go.
You recognize things.
07058, like, my friend.
Tell me a little bit about how the show was a love letter to Jersey.
Well, I mean, David Chase, he and I grew up in adjacent towns. He grew up in Caldwell, you know, about a mile or two from where Tony and Carmela lived.
We played them in football. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, he'd grown up watching and reading about all these stories of gangsters from New York. And, like, New York was the cool place. New Jersey was not. And, you know, even back early in his career when he was writing for James Garner on the Rockford Files, he did a couple of episodes about some wise guys, and he made sure that they were from New Jersey. And one of those episodes you can watch, and it's almost like a prototype for The Sopranos. There's even a mob boss named Anthony, you know, with a son named Anthony Jr. who plays the drums, and cousin Carmela and things like that. But it's deliberate. Like, the show begins with Tony driving out of the Lincoln Tunnel heading west. This is not a New York story. It's a New Jersey story. There's this built-in inferiority complex that Tony grapples with among the many other problems that he has. And it's there to show both some of the ugliness of the state, but also some of the beauty of the state that gets lost in all the, oh, you're from Jersey, what exit jokes that we all grew up with.
Mob stories didn't really go out into the woods as often as The Sopranos did, unless it was to kill somebody. And The Sopranos certainly went into the woods to kill somebody, but they also went out there just because the woods were nice.
Right. Now, you guys were both writing for the Star Ledger at the time?
Yes. Matt covered the show for the first three seasons. I did it for the last four.
How did that change your careers?
Well, it was huge. It was, you know, it was really, really big. And I don't just mean, you know, the attention that we got from being at ground zero on the show, writing about the show. And Alan has compared it to, you know, being the rock critics for a Liverpool paper when the Beatles were coming up. And it does feel like that caliber of big. And it was really wild that we just happened to be there at that particular time. And also that, you know, who we were was particularly suited to that particular show. And I came out of a background of film criticism, you know, in the alternative press, and I was fairly new on the TV beat. And this was a show that, among other things, had aspirations to be taken seriously as cinema, basically, like as, you know, serialized weekly cinema that happened to be on TV. And Alan, with his, you know, his intense interest in the narrative architecture of shows, like this was like an All About Eve situation. I always joke about this. Like, I was young, but Alan was younger. And when he came on board, it was like, oh, that's the end for me. Because when he was in college, he was writing about, you know, NYPD Blue, these things that people in the industry were reading. And it was, you know, do you want to describe what this was?
Well, I was just doing recaps before recaps even had a name. But what was great about The Sopranos was, It made us both better writers because it gave us license to write about TV in a way that people had not written about TV before. And even, you know, back then and even now when we were doing new recaps for the book, I'm just so full of joy writing about this show in a way that I am not about almost anything else I've covered in the 20 years since it debuted, because there's so much to dig into in terms of plot, in terms of theme, in terms of character, symbolism, artistry, all of that in every single episode, in every single scene.
Also, it's funny. And I think that's a big thing that a lot of the shows that came along after The Sopranos tended to miss. It was as funny as any comedy, even when it was being weird, surreal, shocking, grotesque, and all these other things. It was as funny as almost any sitcom you could think of,
and you wrote it was an absurdist comedy.
Yeah, and I think all of the really great shows. I can't think of a truly great show in the history of TV, a drama that wasn't as funny as a really good comedy. I think that's key. And too many of the shows that tried to be The Sopranos afterwards were just very glum. They were very glum, solemn, kind of self-pitying. Affair.
They go about in pity for themselves until a great wind carries them across the sky.
A great wind named Nielsen, I guess. I don't know. But yeah.
The name of the book is The Soprano Sessions. We're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall about the book. You guys had to rewatch all of these episodes.
It was fun.
I was worried. I got to say, I was worried going in because, as Matt said, this was a hugely important show for our careers. It made both of us, you know, put us on the map to where we are now. And it's also, we'd written a lot about how influential and important it was. And so I'm thinking, all right, the business has kind of strip-mined every single aspect of The Sopranos. If you go back and watch it now, is it going to be good or is it just going to seem like a cliche that other things built on and improved upon? It was really good.
Yeah,
in some ways I liked it more than I did, you know, 20 years ago. It was dazzling.
And we were relieved of the burden of having to guess what would happen next and in some cases predict what would happen next. And we have at the back of The Soprano Sessions, we have a section called The Morgue, which is, you know, not as trying to be cute. Of course, that's what, you know, where you put the clippings at when you work at a newspaper. That's where that stuff goes. But we have examples of stuff we actually wrote at the time that we were at the paper. And you can see that there are some things that we called with eerie accuracy and other things that we were laughably wrong about. And one of the pieces that I didn't put in the book because it was just completely useless was near the end of season 3. One of my editors said, I need you to write a wrap-up saying what are all the dangling plot threads that David Chase and the other writers need to wrap up by the end of this season. And it turns out a lot of them were not wrapped up that season and were never wrapped up and were never going to be wrapped up. And so it was like a bullet-pointed list of all this stuff, like they need to resolve the Russians and is there going to be a mob war between the Italians and the Russians and whatever happened to Dr. Melfi's assailant. And, you know, it was like the list. And it basically, as forward-thinking as I fancied myself to be, my brain was still stuck in the pre-Sopranos era of TV where these sorts of things needed to be taken care of. And the show just didn't care about that stuff. It had other things on its mind.
Let's take a listen to a couple of clips you guys have suggested we listen to and talk about. This first one is from Episode 5, Season 1, called College. Tony is driving Meadow to college, and she poses a question.
Are you in the mafia?
Am I in the what?
Whatever you want to call it, organized crime.
That's total crap. Who told you that?
Dad, I've lived in the house all my life. I've seen police come with warrants. I've seen you going out at 3 in the morning.
So you never seen Doc Cusimano go out at 3 in the morning on a call?
Did the Cusimano kids ever find $50,000 in Krugerrands and a 45 automatic while they were hunting for Easter eggs?
I'm in the waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive. And you're the last person I would want to perpetuate it.
Fine.
I love that.
What do you love about that?
Well, a lot of things. One of them is just as a Alan and I are both parents. I think anybody who's a parent can appreciate, you know, being called out on your hypocrisy by your own children, which is something that happens to those of us even who are not in the mafia. You have to face that, you know. It's funny. It's just funny. And also one of the great running gags. There were a lot of great running gags on the show, like these sort of pots of comic gold that they could dip into anytime they felt like it. And number one was Tony, this giant, towering mob boss who can order people executed and sometimes does it himself with his bare hands, is completely incapable of controlling his children. Totally incapable. Like, he can maybe for a day or two he can get them to do what he wants, but ultimately they're going to do their own thing. And it's funny and relatable.
That's the family drama comedy of it all,
it is,
right?
Yeah.
But this is important because this comes in the episode where, 20-year-old spoiler alert, Tony strangles a mob informant to death with his bare hands. Like, this is the episode that made The Sopranos into the phenomenon it became. And it starts off with, you know, Meadow confronting him and questioning him, and he tries to duck it. But by the end of the show, we have seen exactly who and what he is in a way that we didn't understand, you know, even from the previous 4 episodes.
I'm speaking with Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall about their book, The Soprano Sessions. It's part of our Party Like It's 1999 series. Can you believe it? The Sopranos debuted in 1999. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit about James Gandolfini. Listening to all of it on WNYC. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall about their book, The Sopranos Sessions, because The Sopranos debuted in 1999, 20 years ago. Guys, this show, James Gandolfini is this show.
Yeah.
He really is.
He really, really is. I mean, a tremendous cast. We'll talk about some of the other members of the cast, but how did he come to this part?
Well, he auditioned. He read for it, and he was a character actor, a heavily employed character actor at that time. But you know, because of his physical type, he was often cast as hitmen and henchmen and bumbling assistants and people like that. And sometimes he got a nice guy part, like he was Gina Davis's boyfriend in Angie, and you got to see the sweet kind of and sexy side of the guy, you know. But he never had a role like this until he read for it. And we have anecdotes in the book about that process. But Chase talks about how he originally thought about all these different people as Tony, including Steve Van Zandt, who ended up playing Silvio. And if he had cast him, he said the show would have been more of, like, as he put it, a live-action Simpsons. Like, it would have been, you know, much different.
Yeah.
But he said that after he read James Gandolfini for the part, he started to see a different vision of the show, which is eventually what it became. And I think that's a very high compliment to an actor that, based on reading for a part, the person who created the show says, oh, I see other possibilities here. Maybe we should do this.
The book also has just heartbreaking but lovely eulogies of James Gandolfini.
Yeah, that was tough, just for him to be taken away from us, you know, like that. And that was both the best and worst part of rewatching the show for the book was we got to watch Gandolfini, but every time we did, we were reminded of all the performances we were never going to get from him. But it's weird to say, like, I feel like I underrated Jim until I went back to rewatch it this time. I always knew this was one of the great performances of all time. I don't think I quite understood that it was the great performance of all time. Like, there's no TV drama acting Mount Rushmore. There's just his face up on the mountain.
Yeah, it's true. And he was also just, he was a very genuine, real guy. Like, he wasn't like a Hollywood type at all. He fought with the HBO publicist during the, before the premiere of season one, that he didn't want to take a limo to the premiere because he thought his friends would see it and think he had gone Hollywood. He wanted to arrive in a yellow cab. You know, that's the sort of person he was.
He won a Critics Award after the first season, and at Christmas he mailed us all thank yous with his home address handwritten on the back of the envelope.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he would do things like, he would pay for a sushi chef to come in on Fridays when they got their last shot and make sushi for the cast and crew, and he'd pay for it out of his own pocket. He was constantly donating money to charities. David Chase, in his eulogy for Jim, he talked about how he had a pad and a pen with him on the passenger seat whenever he drove, because he would listen to the radio, and if he ever heard of a charitable cause, he would pull over and write down the name of it and then call his people and say, can you please make a donation?
Well, one of the reasons I think he was so perfect for the role is because you said he was charming, and even if you're an actor, that charisma comes through, even if you're playing some other part, right? Yeah. That charm and that warmth and sort of that sexiness, but then how brutal Tony was. They never let you forget Tony was a killer.
Right. No, they did. They never let you forget that.
Which is why college was important and why HBO fought with David Chase about it. They said, if you have him kill this guy, the audience will never forgive him. And Chase said, if he doesn't kill the guy, the audience will never forgive that. They'll believe that he's phony. So they had to sort of carry through it, and they kept pushing that and pushing that over the course of the series, and his behavior got worse and worse. And yet there were still just some people who couldn't quit him because he was just that charismatic, and they just saw something of themselves in him or something of someone they knew in him. And so there were Tony defenders till the end, Christopher defenders till the end, Paulie Walnuts defenders till the end. And I think that kind of drove Chase nuts,
and
too.
Chase kept escalating. He kept escalating the ugliness. You know, like, you can see in the back half of season one, the characters become more openly racist. And in season two, that continues. And in season three, we see them being, like, more openly misogynist. And there's a whole episode that's basically about how part of the mafia's business is the sex trade. You know, but no matter what they did, there were certain people in the audience who still liked them and thought they were cool and fun and people that you want to emulate. And Chase said in the interview that we did, that he got very frustrated by that. And towards the end, people were saying, wow, this show is so ugly. These people are so mean. They're such failures as human beings. Why did I ever watch this show? And it's like, well, finally, we've gotten to the place where I wanted to be at. You know, like, he obviously we're supposed to see ourselves in them, and that makes it complicated and interesting for us, that attraction repulsion, which is, again, is what Melfi had, you know, being kind of a viewer surrogate. But we're not supposed to root for them, but we're also not supposed to condemn them. And that ambivalent place is where the show resides. And that's also exemplified in things like the plot developments that are never resolved because the show has decided that they're not important, like whatever happened to the Russian, or the ending, you know, what happened in the end, to the way that certain plots would build to anticlimax. That was the form. You know, anticlimax as climax was a big part of the show. Like the one that Alan really grew to love, and you didn't like it the first time, was Furio, right?
Yeah, season four, Carmela's flirting with Furio, and I spent the whole season.
That ponytail.
Yeah. Back in 2002, going, is Carmela going to sleep with Furio? When is that going to happen? And how's Tony going to react when he finds out? And is Tony going to fight Furio? And could Furio actually beat Tony? And could Furio kill Tony? And what does the show become then? And, you know, I'm getting very excited, and nothing happens. Right. Nothing at all happens. He leaves.
He has an opportunity to kill Tony, but he doesn't have the nerve, and he just leaves.
Yeah, and so in 2002, I was exasperated by it, but because I came back this time and I knew what was coming, I could focus more just on like what that story was telling us about the interior life of Carmela Soprano and how she's so frustrated and so angry about the state of her own life that she's willing to kick Tony out of the house at the end of that season.
And you even see, like, even in little touches, like at the beginning of season three, the entire episode is about the FBI trying to plant a surveillance device in the Soprano home, and they get a bugged lamp into the basement, which is where some of the very most important secretive conversations on the show happen. You think, oh my God, this is going to be major. And then a few episodes later, Meadow comes down to the basement. It's like, hey, Dad, are you using this lamp? She's like, no. She takes it to college with her. And that's it.
Let's talk about some of the other really fine casting in this show. What do you think? Give me two examples that you think really, had the casting been different, the show would have been different.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine anybody but Edie Falco as Carmela. And what I love the most about her is her absolute lack of sentimentality in the part. And I would say, you know, I think there's so much attention paid to Jim, not just because he was great, but also because he died too young, that I think we tend to forget that she was there matching him beat for beat. And she was the only character on the show who was powerful enough to not get completely steamrolled by him in a scene. And she, I would say, in her own way, although her character did not personally murder anyone, she could be just as chilling. Like that whole plot line where she's trying to get the recommendation to Columbia.
I want that letter.
I want that letter. I don't understand. She says, I don't think you understand. I need you to write that letter. Like, and she says it very politely. And yeah, see, and we all felt the hair raise on the backs of our necks exactly, yes.
And the funny thing is, if you look at all the shows that came after The Sopranos that we've already talked about, on all those shows, the fans hate the wives. It's this really unfortunate misogynistic reaction where, like, Skyler White and Betty Draper and all the wives of the, you know, on paper despicable anti-heroes, people turn against them because they're getting in the way of the anti-heroes' fun. And that never really happened on Sopranos, and I think a lot of that is just a testament to how good Edie Falco was and how easily she was able to make you sympathize with Carmela.
And also the writing of the part. You know, they were always very clear that Carmela, like a lot of the women in this universe, were complicit in the evil of that world. And they knew it, and they decided to pretend that they weren't aware of it, and that was part of the devil's bargain. And in the episode from season three where Carmela goes to therapy with this guy, Dr. Krakauer, who only has one scene in the whole show, you really feel that coming clear. And he essentially tells her, this is a state of spiritual rot that you're stuck in, and you have to take the kids, or what's left of them, as he puts it, and leave. And she doesn't.
Let's take a listen to something from that scene.
Have you ever read Crime and Punishment? Dostoevsky. It's not an easy read. It's about guilt and redemption. And I think for your husband to turn himself in, read this book, and reflect on his crimes every day for 7 years in his cell, then he might be redeemed.
I would have to get a lawyer, find an apartment, arrange for child support.
You're not listening. I'm not charging you because I won't take blood money. You can't either. One thing you can never say, that you haven't been told.
Holy cow.
We have to talk about the ending of the show. The ending of the show. I remember the next morning, just people not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
Who are true Sopranos fans. Yes. We all stayed up. We all watched. We'd all been to that. Anybody from Jersey had been to Holstein.
Right.
And you, did he die? Did he not? What happened?
Well.
What happened?
Well, I'll tell you what happened at my house, which is I was watching it on a slight delay because I was having trouble putting my son to bed. So I arrived at the ending probably, you know, 7 minutes maybe after the when it was supposed to end, and my phone was ringing off the hook. Like, this is the old days when the landline took most of the phone traffic, and it was like ring, 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 answering machine, answering machine, answering machine. And I was like, what the hell's going on? And I thought, it's another 9/11. That was what I thought. I thought some kind of national emergency and people are calling to see if I'm okay. But they were all calling to say, what the hell was that ending?
What the hell was that ending?
Well, I went through a lot of different opinions and theories about it over the years. And when we came time to do this book and interview David Chase for it, we knew that we would have to try to get him to talk about the ending, which he famously does not like to do. He didn't do it with me the morning after the show aired when I did that one interview with him. Hasn't really done it in the year since. And we did 7 interviews with him, and we knew we would get to it in the 7th interview. And in kind of classic Sopranos fashion, the climax instead came in the interview before that, where unexpectedly...
Right. Yeah, the timing was not what we thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Which is inadvertently perfect.
I asked him on a largely unrelated question, just about more generally about planning to end the show. And he just says without thinking, well, you know, I had that death scene in my mind for about 2 years before we did it. Yes. And your
record
head.
Record scratch.
Head just perked up like ours did.
Yeah.
Matt says, David, you realize you just said death scene. And he realized what he'd said and his eyes narrowed. And he said something to us that we can't repeat on the radio. And then we laughed for a long time. And then, like a dam had burst, he started talking about the ending. And by the end of it, like, we didn't necessarily have any greater clarity on what happened, but I think we understood finally what his intentions were. And for a show like The Sopranos, I think that's the more interesting thing.
I think he, you know, just to sum it, people ask me, like, well, what was he meaning to do? And I like, this is just my theory, okay? This is not what he told us. This is my interpretation of it. But essentially, he had this idea for how to end the show, which was going to be Tony getting in his car and driving through the Lincoln Tunnel for a meeting with Johnny Sack, the New York mob boss. I guess hat in hand, like things aren't going well for his family. And as he's driving through the tunnel, it either fades to white or cuts to black. And it's like the reverse of the opening credits, the way the mm-hmm. credits start. And although, you know, it's not a total full bore, you know, art house head scratcher ending, it's a little ambiguous. But basically, you kind of like, whatever happened, it couldn't have been good. You know, like it feels like a death scene that's not a death scene. Well, he abandoned that, and he did what we eventually saw, which is the scene at Holston's with the family eating the onion rings like they're, you know, communion wafers, and the members only jacket guy and the, you know, the Boy Scouts and the Journey blasting, and, you know, it's crazy. And he wanted to make a statement, you know, as he put it, more about the fragility of life. And as Alan has subsequently put it, which I think is quite nice, it's a scene, even if you think he lived or died, whether you think he lived or died, it's a scene about death. And about the prospect of death looming over us, I think that's a very good reading. But as far as people coming away from it still saying, yeah, but he died, right? My theory is, and this is 12 years of therapy talking, I believe him when he says that this is not supposed to give the message Tony died. I believe him, and I think we owe it to him to take him at his word. I don't think he's lying to us. I don't think he's faking anything. However, I think that a lifetime of watching movies, gangster movies, where the hero gets killed at the end, and the fact that he had this original conception that was going to at least imply that he died, I think somewhere in the back of his mind he did kill Tony. I think he didn't mean to give that impression. I think he was very meticulous in how he constructed the scene, but I think something subconscious bubbled up and gave it this flavor of he whacked Tony, you know? And to me, this is an example of, you know, a thing that I'm really fascinated by. All of my interviews with creative people eventually come back to this, that there's this idea that everything an artist does is intentional, meaning it's on purpose and it's conscious. But I think there's different kinds of intentionality. And like, we see this in our own life. I mean, how often have you done something over and over and over and over again? And each time you're like, I didn't mean to do that. Why did I do that? That's crazy. Why would I do something like that? It's like, well, because you meant to do it.
Yeah.
Even if
yeah.
you didn't mean to do it, you meant to do it. And the seemingly irreconcilable contradiction of this is just a part of human nature. And like, why wouldn't it also be true of David Chase as he's making this television show?
Or it could mean, this has been my theory, is that anytime a door opens, Tony could die.
That's true. And in fact, that was Alan's original take, right?
Yeah. Well, my original take back 12 years ago was just the scenes about sort of the paranoia that he has a fate worse than death, which is he's always going to believe he could die. But if you watch the scene, he's not worried at all. He's enjoying himself. We're the ones who are being sort of driven mad by waiting for Meadow to parallel park the car. but I think it's really just about this idea that, like, we're here temporarily. We're here on loan. That loan can be called back at any time without warning, without us having anything to do with it. And that could be the moment for Tony, or it couldn't, but it certainly feels like it is, and it gives you that feeling more than almost anything else I've ever seen conveyed in any form of art of the fragility of our existence here.
Both could be true.
Yes, they both could be true, and I'm a big fan of this idea of, you know, it doesn't have to be either or, it can be both and. You know, mm-hmm. It's okay. It's okay for things to be, you know, more than one idea can coexist simultaneously. And in fact, that makes art more interesting, I think.
We've been talking about the 20th anniversary. What do you think The Sopranos would have been like if it debuted now?
Well, but I don't know that we can answer that question, because what does TV look like now if The Sopranos does not exist?
Like, yeah. What would my life be like if my dad had never met my mother? Well, you know what I mean?
Let me re-ask it.
Okay.
What if Netflix was producing The Sopranos? Would we get them all at once?
Yeah.
Would it have the same impact if you could watch them all at the same time?
No, because a lot of it was just the conversation every week. I also think that the show would be made differently. One of the things that the Netflix shows and a lot of the ones that have followed The Sopranos, the lessons that they learned incorrectly is people just want, like, pure serialized drama, just to be continued. That's not what The Sopranos is, and that was clear when we rewatched it for the book, is it's a lot of short stories that eventually cohere into something serialized by the end of the season, but each episode on its own stands alone and works as something, you know, as a compelling piece of art, and a lot of these serialized streaming shows do not do that. It's just 10 hours of plot, which does not hold up well. I can't imagine ever wanting to go back and rewatch, you know, Ozark or some of these other things.
Or like Daredevil or something, you know? Whereas, like, I know people are fans of that, but to me it's just like almost all of those Netflix Marvel shows are like 13 hours of plot and, you know, 13 hours of storytelling, and there's probably maybe 4 or 5 hours of plot in there.
But even the ones that I like, I don't feel like I need to go back and watch again. Whereas, you know, we rewatched The Sopranos, and this morning I got to my office and I just needed to have something on the TV while I was getting set up. And I thought, maybe I just want to watch The Sopranos again.
You know, another thing that jumped out at me on rewatching this was that every scene, like, even if a scene didn't seem like it was momentous, something was happening. Like, something important was happening on the show. And even if it seemed like a throwaway scene that was just about a character being eccentric and interesting and funny, something important about them, about the plot, or about that world was being conveyed. And if you weren't paying attention, you would miss it. And later on, it would come up, because the show had a memory like an elephant, and it didn't forget anything, and it was constantly saving string, you know, and at some point in the future, you know, things that you thought were, it was funny because we've just talked about how certain things were not resolved and you never heard about them again. But there are other things where you thought, you know, like the Russian disappears and you never find out what happened to the Russian. But, you know, Tony loses his gun in the snow when he's running away from Johnny Sack, and you think that's not going to be important, and the gun shows up again. And there were constantly things like that happening, and they kept you off balance. They really kept you off balance throughout the show. Like, and that's great, because it's a lively, alert experience watching the show. And I think a lot of shows that are being made now, it's very weird how it's circled around, but it used to be, and this was kind of encoded in the DNA of network TV shows that David Chase came up on, and he hated it. They wrote these shows and produced these shows in a way that you didn't really have to be paying attention. Like Alan was saying, you know, you could watch every fourth episode and basically know what's going on. The stories, you know, the beginning, middle, and end, it all wrapped up in the space of an hour or a half an hour. And you could be kind of half watching while you're folding your laundry or arguing with your kids or whatever, and you don't feel lost, you know, when you're watching the show. That wasn't the case with The Sopranos, and a lot of the really great dramas, I don't think it's the case with them either. Like The Wire, one of the reasons The Wire was not a big rating success was because it asked too much of the audience. You know, you could, like, look away for 5 seconds and there could be some really important piece of plot information that's happening, not just in the foreground, but in the background of a shot. And if you were, you know, scrolling Instagram, you're not going to know what's going on. You won't know, you know, some enormous plot development could happen an hour from now and you'll go, where did that come from? Well, it happened while you weren't looking.
Before I let you go, my two favorite things that or things that stick in my mind, Carmela's nails.
Yep.
Yeah.
And poor you.
Poor you. That's
very good.
The great phrase, when Tony starts saying it in the later seasons, that's when you know he is irrevocably lost.
What's your favorite line from the show?
Most of them I can't say on the air, but so a lot of my favorites are things that Steve Van Zandt said that are not funny on the page, but the way he said them was. And one of the ones that always sticks out to me is Tony is lecturing the other captains because receipts are down. And he says, Syl, what two businesses have been recession-proof since time immemorial? And Silvio steps up and says, certain aspects of showbiz and our thing.
What about you?
The line that I'm not kidding. The line that I think of almost every single day at some point is Tony when he's recovering from being shot and he says, "They say every day is a gift, but why does it have to be a pair of socks?"
The name of the book is The Soprano Sessions, Metzler Sites, and Alan Stephenwell. Thank you so much for walking us through this. Really appreciate this.
That's our absolute pleasure.
And Alan will be signing books and giving a talk at Words in Maplewood, New Jersey on January 22nd. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Now is the time in the week on All of It when we try to help you sort through what's happening around town. For instance, in Brooklyn this weekend, you might like to check out the mega talents of the folks participating in the New York State Pinball Championship. It's at the Sunshine Laundromat in Greenpoint. Admission is free, by the way. And on the Upper West Side, you could check out a play called Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, the true story of Linda Blackman Lowry, based on her book of the same name, about her journey as the youngest person to march in the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. And we're going to have Linda on the show on Monday as well. This play incorporates gospel and spiritual music, and it's running this weekend at Riverside Church. And for even more weekend picks, we have two special guests. The first, of course, is Charlie Herman, our culture editor, Charlie for the Culture. So what do I need? You're going to tell me one thing I need to see and one thing that's closing that I must see before it goes away.
Exactly. So first up, what you need to see or consider seeing or check out is a new work, a world premiere by the composer Julia Wolf that'll be at the New York Philharmonic starting next week, Thursday through Saturday. The work is called Fire in My Mouth, and it is about the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, where 146 garment workers, mostly women, largely immigrants, had died during a fire that broke out there. And this is just really a seminal event in the history of the labor movement in this country and of women working and just the way that we work and safety conditions. The title itself refers to the fire, of course, Fire in My Mouth, but also there was a Ukrainian immigrant labor activist who talked about at that time when she was, you know, radicalized and protesting that she had a fire in her mouth. Hmm. So this is a new work that has been a co-commission from the New York Philharmonic. And what they've done is sort of built a two-week series of events around it, calling it New York Stories, Threads of the City. And really what they're trying to do is examine the roots of immigrants in this country and, you know, the progression of immigrants coming here, who came here. They felt that, obviously, this is a very timely conversation to have right now. And they've been doing events at the Tenement Museum. They have an archival show that's actually at Geffen Hall at the Philharmonic. They're doing other works, other presentations of other music. But this is really the big show that they're doing.
And Julia Wolf, was she a MacArthur person?
I mean, there is an award. If there's an award out there, she has won it. She was a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient in 2016. In 2019, she's been named the Composer of the Year by Musical America. She also won a Pulitzer Prize for her work Anthracite Fields, which is about the Pennsylvania coal miners. And she used oral histories and interviews and speeches to really create and depict this world of coal miners. And this isn't the first time she's done this. She did this also with another work that was about John Henry and looking at labor and workers in this country. And in a way, Fire in My Mouth is a third version of this. This is sort of part of a trilogy. Now it's looking at women and the workplace. You know, and people hear of the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, but the details of it, I mean, it's just, it is it's really unbelievable when you think about it. When this fire broke out that lasted all of about 18 minutes, these women died because there were just a lack of basic safety features like sprinklers. There was only one fire escape. Only one elevator worked. The doors were locked. The ladders only reached up to the seventh floor from the fire department, but the fire was at the eighth, ninth, and tenth floors. So this was just such a huge event that what Wolf has done is similar with these other works is look at the oral histories and read about it and the interviews that were done and really try and put together a work that encapsulates the what happened. And so what we're expecting to hear are everything from the sounds recreating the sewing machines or singing in Italian and Yiddish, because those are the people who worked at the factory. In fact, earlier this week at the Tenement Museum, which if you think about it is so poignant because this is where so many of these women lived, they did some of the singing that you'll hear. So we have a clip of that. And keep in mind, this is a cappella. What you will hear are, you know, over 100 singers and a full orchestra. But this is the final movement when all you hear are the names of the women being sung aloud, the women who died. It moves me every time I hear it.
Lizzie Adler, Anna Altman, Rose Vecino, Yetta Berger, Adelina Arnstein, Jacob Bernstein, Jessie Arnstein, Gracie Mirowitz, Rosie Berger.
So it promises to be a really interesting show and something worth checking out.
That was beautiful. What's closing?
What's closing is Sarah Lucas Au Naturel at the New Museum. This is the British artist. This is the first major retrospective of her work
here. Oh, we had her on.
Oh, you had her on. And then you had her on back when you started in the show.
Yeah,
she was one of your first guests.
One of our first guests, yeah.
So that show is now closing. Definitely worth checking out, exploring issues of men and women and privilege. And it is just, it's an intense show. Some people might think it's in your face, but I think it's a really good show, good work, and worth checking out before it closes on Sunday.
Oh, it's in your face. But we have a special guest, Charlie. We have an artist in studio.
An artist in studio.
Who has an opening tonight. Artist and illustrator Elise Angler has completed several projects depicting the things we see around us every day, making art out of what's right in front of us, our storefronts, our possessions. And the topic of Elise's latest project is she creates a drawing a day based on headlines she hears on the radio, often coming from right here.
Right here at the station.
Her opening tonight is at the Esther Masra Gallery. Esther Masra Gallery. That's actually up in Albany, so this is for our friends who are up driving up 87. But the exhibit will be coming to New York City on April 11th. Elise, welcome.
Thank you.
So why did you start drawing headlines? I love this.
I often have done sort of time-based work, and I also listen to the radio. Like many artists in New York, we are all over, I think. You have kind of radio as the background, and it's great for having on while I'm sitting and drawing. Mm-hmm. It's nice. The nice thing about being an artist as opposed to a writer, where you really, I don't think, can have the radio on. It's too distracting. So, and because I'm a news junkie, and because I really do listen, and I'm a sort of accumulator of information, I thought, how can I put all that together? And I sort of started drawing first kind of arbitrarily. It wasn't the same station. It wasn't the same time. Still not the same time. It's basically NYC and Democracy Now. So I take headlines from there. And it's because I'm interested in the news. And I started this. It has nothing to do with our current 45. It has nothing to do with him. I started before him. But, of course, he has a prominent position.
Do you, as you are hearing a headline, does the picture immediately come to you, the image come to you, or is it kind of the other way around? So say you were interested in the detention centers. Are you listening for a detention center headline, or is it the other way around?
No, I listen and I really hear what happens that day. I really listen in the morning and whatever comes up as a headline.
So when do you usually start listening? At 6 a.m., 7 a.m.? Is there a particular time where you turn the radio on? And how long does it take you to make one of the works?
Ideally, I wish I was listening later, but this project has made me get up way too early in the morning. So sometimes I'm at 5 o'clock. I hear the headlines
because
that's
feed.
When the first feed. Exactly. I feel like, oh, you know, here comes Richard Hake, or you know.
Please draw Richard Hake one day. He's a handsome fellow, by the way. I'll introduce you to him on the
way.
So
how long does it take you to put them to bring it together?
It depends. Some of them are a little quicker. It depends on my day. If I have to go to work, what's happening in the news. There's many elements, but they can take anywhere from 2 to 7 hours.
It's so interesting that you would be moved to do this every day. I know a lot of artists have to sit and think a long time. Does it just come out of you I mean, are you just moved to do it? I'm sort of fascinated by this, that you do this every day, that you're that religious about it.
Well, I think my personal history of art making has a lot to do with being very particular and focused. So if I start something, like I drew everything I owned, and I spent a year and a half without drawing anything else. I drew 13,127 objects. That was 20 years ago. And then...
Did you have to draw objects of what you were drawing? Because those become an object.
Yes. Yes. That's how I finished it. That was the tail end. And then,
that's so great.
And then I drew every block of Broadway. So that was, I had to do every block, and I had to do it in a year. So this was initially going to be a one-year project, by the way. It was going to be 2016. I started it before that, a year before.
Is that? Do you think that's because the news cycle has become so omnipresent in all of our lives?
Absolutely. I felt like I can't stop now. I am documenting this bizarre and rather frightening trajectory, and I think I've created an amazing kind of, not to promote myself, but this visual record of what's happened in the last 1,154 days.
Do you look back at earlier ones and see a progression like, wow, a year ago, 2 years ago, I was looking at this and I drew it this way. Now I look at it now and it hasn't really evolved, or it has evolved. Or do you see trajectories?
Well, there's certain people who run through. There's like a constant thread of people, the obvious and then not so obvious. You know, there's trials and then there's convictions, or there's occurrences and then there's what happens after. Also, I've noticed, just because I drew lots of things and I've drawn lots of landscapes and I haven't done a lot of portraits, so portraits have become much easier to draw.
Do you ever find, though, that you can't escape from the news?
Oh, she's brought, look at this, Charlie.
That's great.
These are great.
Do you ever wish...
Elizabeth Warren.
Do you find that you want to escape from the news sometimes? Or do you feel I'm trapped in a way that I have to do this every day, so whether I like it or not, I'm going to have to listen to what's happening?
I'm in it.
You're in it.
I'm in it. I did take 11 days off. I invited 11 guest artists so that the project continued while I was away, but I did take a little break, and every day I posted somebody else's work.
Have you drawn Allison yet?
I have not drawn Allison.
Oh.
But
well,
I could.
Well, I need to do something newsworthy first.
Yeah.
Let me do something incredibly newsworthy first. I love this one. I love that they're also, they're like collages in a way, because it's not just one headline. For the example, the one I'm holding now is January 8th, 2019. It's Ruth Bader Ginsburg, how she would be on the bench for the Supreme Court. You also have the felons in Florida getting the right to vote. That John Bolton?
Yes.
John Bolton.
You can tell by the mustache.
It's the stash. She got the stash perfectly. Your President Trump is pretty great.
It's sort of an orangish glow.
But childlike. He's very childlike.
Who's your favorite person to draw, or the most interesting person that you draw?
Oh, my God. That's a hard question. I mean, I look at each person as if I've never seen them before. So whatever I do, it's as if I really try and look at everything really freshly. So
are you doing it from memory, or are you?
No. I use screenshots. I go online and I get videos. Mm-hmm. I try not to take anybody's still photos because I don't want to steal anybody else's work. But I do use their work in little bits and pieces. You know, but I try and use a lot of video.
And what's it like to have the show?
Oh, well, right now it's up. I want to thank Jean Flanagan, who has put it together.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
an amazing curator, an amazing gallery director at the College of St. Rose. And she's been doing it for a long time, and her work is fantastic. And we put it up, and it's a wall. It's 35 feet long by 10 feet.
Wow.
And so it's covered. And then there's also my Broadway project is there too. And there's a sculptor named Isidro Blasco, and his work is there also.
The other thing I love about it is it's national as well as local. And this one,
yes.
for example, you have Alexander Hamilton, when Lin-Manuel Miranda and Tommy from Hamilton fame bought the drama bookstore. That's such a great one to memorialize as well, because that's just a little moment in time that's going to slip away. It's not going to be a headline forever.
And it's also something good. I mean, it does get depressing having to draw sure. every day about how people's rights are being taken away, or about how people's children are being taken away. Or I like to be able to make something that has, I mean, it has to be a little bit fun even for me. And also I like, you know, the process of drawing such a variety of things, the actual painting and drawing things that are entirely different and surprising every day.
Do you know when you'll be done?
No. it's not dependent on the news cycle. It's dependent on me waking up and saying, I'm done, I can't do anymore.
And it's like a diary entry, because when I just looked at one of those and I see Schumer and Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi, Speaker of the House, standing next to one another, I know exactly where that is. I'm transported immediately when I saw that. So it is like a visual journal that you open up from years ago and you can remember what's going on then.
The gallery opening is tonight at the Esther Masri Gallery at the College of St. Rose in Albany. And this will be coming to New York City?
To Frosch and Portman Gallery on April 11th, and that's in the Lower East Side on Stanton Street.
Elise Engler, thank you so much for coming in to all of it.
Well,
thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you, and these are beautiful. I love seeing these.
Thank you.
Oh, go to Eve's Twitter, Elise's Twitter. You can see it there.
And Instagram.
Instagram as well. Charlie, thanks to you too.
You bet.
And everybody who's been listening, thank you so much for spending part of your day with us here at All of It. Be good, be kind, and we'll see you next time.